Come blast off in my time machine. Third eye feeling like an Evazine. Blast off, blast off, blast off, blast off. Come blast off in my time machine. Third eye feeling like an Evazine. Blast off, blast off, blast off, blast off.
Blast off on another episode of Hero. That's right, my name is Ryan, the original outlaw of the airwaves, bringing you another VIP episode, recording just south of Area 51 at the base of La Madre Mountain. We're delving into it today, guys. As if that's not the norm, bringing you the stanky, grassroots, local flavor everyone is striving for these days, but I'm talking about on a higher scientific plane, and not only that, This is above and beyond, really, my pay grade. The manuscript that we are going to delve into, I was astounded. It is really, really cool. We're talking about lost technologies of the Great Pyramid. And really, it's amazing. The construction work of the Great Pyramid, the illustrations, the dedication that really went into making this. And I'm talking about this amazing book by Stephen Myers, and it's not just the book. And there's a lot more to it. He has videos that go with it, electronic, mechanical, you know, all kinds of different formats. And he really, you know, is, as near as I can tell, is the only one who's really put a lot into this and figured something out that maybe all of us need to look at. Definitely check out thepump.org and the Lost Technologies of the Great Pyramid, How the Great Pyramid Was Built by Stephen Myers. Now, the interesting thing about this amazing book is just its mass. It's huge. And it takes roughly, I mean, it goes into detail about the King's Chamber vents, the Queen's Chamber vents, descending passages, the dead-end shafts, how all of these shafts are used. And we're going to talk about this because there's so much to discuss and so many issues to address that it's difficult to know where to start. While some of the people interested in knowing how the massive stones of the Great Pyramid were moved and set in place, others want to know where this radical theory came from. So before we get into that, let me get into this. If you haven't become a patron yet, patrons are kind of who keep me going. Without the patrons, it cannot continue. So if you're not a patron yet, just go to heroparanormal.com and hit that first button that pops up. And for the cost of a designer cup of coffee a month, boom, you're in. You're in the circle of trust, and you'll get more content than regular people. And avoid all the pitfalls of trying to figure out which episode you watched, which you didn't. Everything gets shot to your email immediately. So that's kind of cool. Without further ado, let's get to it. Stephen Myers, Lost Technologies of the Great Pyramid. Welcome to the Hero Podcast.
Hello.
Hi, Mr. Stephen Myers. I can't be more excited to talk to you. How have you been?
Very good. I've been busy, been doing some talk shows, and I'm happy to be talking with you.
Well, I can't be happier to talk to you. Your book series, your website, and the video series explaining everything is wow. And I wanted to kind of attack some of the stuff in your book, The Lost Technologies, because I think there's so much truth in this book, and I loved how you jokingly, you just kind of, the writing is amazing, but you kind of go about it in a very joking fashion, which I think is unique.
Well, I appreciate that.
I don't know where to start.
We can talk about anything.
Okay. I don't know where to start. I was blown away by the symbol that looks like a Chevy.
I don't either.
Vehicle, you know. Yeah, there's so much. I wanted to get into what else? Tom and the Arrowheads. Let me start here. Something I ask a lot of my guests, so listeners get to know them, is who is Stephen Myers and how did you get involved with this passion?
Well, I am Stephen Myers. I'm a person that has a very technical background, degree in electronics, that type of thing, amateur radio operator, collect antique gasoline engines, and more not very interested in politics, but technology, yes, you know, kind of a computer nut, and that type of thing. But I also like history, so if a person likes technology and history, probably they'll at least consider the Great Pyramid. So that's how I got into it.
So neat. It is so neat. And I wanted to get into a little bit of your book. And I mean, what a massive undertaking and how much information is in that book. There's so much information in there. And how go a little bit into your nonprofit as well.
Well, yes. My interest, because I'm interested in technology, is not the who built the Great Pyramid or what language they spoke or what gods they worshipped, but...
Oh, man. Oh, we may have lost you there for a second. I think I hear you coming back on. Hello? Hello? Yep, there you are.
Into a big pile and why they would do such a thing. So, and then ultimately, that interest became a passion and a life quest, and I've started a 501c3 nonprofit foundation whose website is at thepump.org, and it's about redeveloping the ancient high technology of the Great Pyramid to help our modern but very troubled times.
Fascinating stuff. And if I'm not mistaken, you have a $50,000 scholarship for someone just kind of sitting there if they can just show that it works, correct?
Well, the scholarship actually is quite specific. It is to make a casing stone that the Great Pyramid used to be covered in the manner that Egyptologists say it was done. And that scholarship requires that they quarry and make a casing stone, like Egyptologists say. All their books, even in the 21st century, say that they used hand tools, working people, and peasants made these casing stones all day long, yet Egyptology has never made one. So... we are trying to compel, absolutely force somebody or motivate them to engage in the scientific method and make a casing stone. In other words, to perform a demonstration that would validate the story that Egyptology has come up with, but they don't provide a demonstration. So that's the scholarship. So if somebody had a few bronze chisels and maybe some Doriite pounders, they can make a casing stone and get $50,000. But no one has seemed to have done that. No Great Pyramid casing stones have been made in an authentic manner, the way Egyptologists say they were made in the last 1,000 years. So
that seems fairly easy.
Because of the downturn in the economy, we lost our funding for that. Mm. But we still have that website, that page is still on our website because as a teaching tool. So we're seeking funding for that scholarship. But we had funding for quite a while, like 6 or 7 years, and no one ever took us up on actually doing what Egyptologists say was done all day long.
And that is something that I wanted to bring up, is that might be a good place. You walk the walk and talk the talk. In contrast, I think most Egyptologists are interested in studying and interested in studying only. You're interested in more the doing aspect once the studying is done.
I am interested in that. I would put it this way. Egyptology is the only science that does not engage in the scientific method. Egyptology has never moved a full-size, largest stone of the Great Pyramid 1 inch, although they say, oh, yeah, working people can move them all day long. And Egyptologists have never made, like I said, a casing stone the way they say it was done in all their little drawings and their books. So I think Egyptology is a science that is actually in crisis right now because they have chosen not to engage in a scientific method. And I have a YouTube channel that has a video of titled, Is Egyptology a Pseudoscience? And again, it's in crisis. I don't know anyone that's past the eighth grade that has looked into it that thinks this extremely large-scale precision stone cutting was accomplished using lab tools. So, but Egyptologists still teach that in college here and now. So it's odd. Other researchers like Christopher Dunn, one of his themes is that Egyptology cannot demonstrate the methods that they say it was done.
It's very strange. And it's a good segue. If it's okay, I'd like to read a portion of your book. This is from about a third or a fourth of the way in. And it basically says, Egyptology has degraded into a bizarre mystery religion headed by an elitist priesthood, glorifying an ancient golden objects and ritually reciting the tenets of ramp dogma on the basis of technology required to build the Great Pyramid. And what was available to the ancient Egyptians, the context of the Great Pyramid has not been established by demonstration. Much like you're saying, there's a lot of just agreeance.
Yes, that's called unanimity of expert opinion. And in the realm of science, unanimity of expert opinion doesn't validate anything. So if a bunch of people are all taught the same thing and all repeat what they all say, that's an echo chamber. That's not a validation of an interpretation of evidence. So there are other sciences, like phrenology, about the bumps on people's heads and how that correlates to character traits taught in universities. All phrenologists believe the same thing. But that didn't validate what they said, even though it was a big, I hate to use this term, a big circle jerk mm-hmm. of understanding. And just recently, 50, 60 years ago, phrenology was taught in universities, maybe a little longer than 50 years ago. Time goes by. But that science has ceased to exist because it couldn't withstand the rigors of the scientific method. Egyptology is headed on the same path.
Yes, it is. And I wanted to make a distinction that you actually walk the walk and you've gone to Egypt, you've done the footwork, and I want to just cut to the chase and kind of tell listeners what this is about, but It's basically a water pump. And how do we get into that? Is that, Mr. Myers, is that just the way to do it?
It is the way to do it. We think that the Great Pyramid actually helped people in the real world, that it wasn't built for religion, it wasn't built for symbology, it wasn't built to point to something, it wasn't built to tell us that they knew pi. All of those reasons to move 6 million tons of stone are really small returns on investment than what I consider to be a very large return on investment, that the Great Pyramid was infrastructure for the civilization that built it. It was created to provide prosperity for the people that built it. Which is like their kids could eat every day, that type of thing. It turned the desert into a garden. Mm-hmm. And it also transformed toil into leisure. So I did all of that by being a water pump. So that's what we contend, that the Great Pyramid was built using water locks and barges, and it was built to be a massive infrastructure that provided prosperity for the people that built it.
And, you know, that just makes sense. It seems like, you know, 1,000 different paths to happiness with a water pump of that size. And some of these other explanations really don't explain the toil. There's no reward on the other side of that.
That's true. I think that the builders of the Great Pyramid were geniuses. Okay? That's a presupposition. But imagine in the here and now, we could build a big, giant pyramid or something, a big structure, that symbolically tells people 10,000 years from now that we knew pi, or that would symbolically point to something. We can do that as a civilization. But the reason why we don't do that is because to do that would be stupid.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't help. It wouldn't be justified. There, you know, it would be insane to do that, to spend $50 billion to have something point to something. So, no, those are very, those interpretations of the direct physical evidence don't ring true to a lot of people. But in the here and now, we built, let's say, the Grand Coulee Dam. It was the largest structure in the world up in Washington State on the Columbia River, and it makes electricity, but it also pumps water. It irrigates about 1.5 million acres. It's a self-powered water pump. So that made sense to do that. And the electricity, all it is electrons going through a wire. But it is many paths to prosperity. You know, we use these phones, computers, lights, power industry with that electricity. So, yeah, so the Great Pyramid was similar in that it was infrastructure to provide prosperity, huge return on investment. So that's a cornerstone of the focus of my research, that the Great Pyramid actually helped people.
And I don't want to jump around, but you mentioned cornerstone, and you've gone to such great lengths as to explain why the corners were built the way they were. And I just want to go into a bit more about the context and how, much like everything you're saying, the context must be in the context within the physical evidence that we're dealing with. And the physical evidence we're dealing with does not lend credence to what most Egyptologists are claiming, which is really kind of ignorance.
It is. We could spend a whole hour talking about Egyptologists. The difference between an Egyptologist and a tomb robber is an Egyptologist has a college education and a tomb robber don't.
Mm-hmm.
So Egyptology's genesis is from robbing tombs and stealing artifacts, if you will. So you know, they encounter the Great Pyramid, and their mindset tells them, evidently that's a great big tomb that we could steal stuff out of, but people a long time ago stole all the good stuff out of it, and because all the treasure and the money's gone, that proves that it's a tomb. I mean, yeah, Egyptology has some real issues, and so it's...
Yeah, it does.
It's a science that is a struggle. Our foundation has a welder that's helping us in our facility, mm-hmm. and he's much more viable than an Egyptologist ever would be, because this guy that can weld, he can actually do something as opposed to Egyptologists.
That's right. And I don't want to keep going down the Egyptologist route as well, but most agree that an alternate research has kind of proven that I guess it would be called the causeway or the causeway ramp, an elevate that would be used to elevate stones. and there's really no explanation for the causeway ramp in most other theories. Is that true?
Well, I can't speak for other people's theories. I think that there is a causeway from the Great Pyramid going down to the Nile used to be much closer in ancient times, but there is a causeway. We think the barges were moved down that causeway, and it's indicated the specifics in our video series on our website that people can watch for free to find out. It's very visual with a lot of computer-generated animations. But we give a functional purpose for the causeway, while other people just say, it's religious or something like that. There's also very huge two sun barges, they're called, mm-hmm. that were entombed right next to the Great Pyramid. And Egyptologists say, those must have been used to carry the Pharaoh's mummy to the Great Pyramid or something like that.
That's what I was always taught.
We give a functional purpose for those large barges that they could disassemble, huge ships that you could take apart, if you will. And we think that those were used as floating cranes, if you will. So there's a lot of, we all have the same direct physical evidence, but there's certainly different interpretations of that same evidence.
Yes, there is. And, it's funny you mentioned the ships, because that's what I was taught. That's what everyone was taught, is that these ships were an over-glorified excess of wealth and how they can carry that wealth into the afterlife. And it makes no virtual sense. Like you're saying, in context, this makes no virtual sense as physical evidence. And I wanted to bring up the story of Tom and the Arrowheads without giving too much away. Is that something you could tell our listeners about?
Yes, it's about issues with demonstrations that to justify somebody's interpretation of evidence of a neighbor kid. He's grown up now, but he came over with an arrowhead. I've got quite a shop, a workshop with a metal lathe, and I do a whole bunch of stuff.
Awesome.
So he came over and he said, "Hey, here's this arrowhead. How is it made?" And the kid's really sharp. So I grabbed a piece of soapstone, which is stone, mm-hmm. and I got my pocket knife out, and I carved an arrowhead out of soapstone. And I told him, I said, "Here you go. I've demonstrated how it's made." But the kid, he was really smart, and I was able to draw this out of him. He says, "Well, it sort of looks like an arrowhead, but it's kind of different than this one that I have. The one that I have is really sharp. And the soapstone one wasn't." And then he kind of messed with it and broke the soapstone arrowhead in half. And he said, "Well, your demonstration, ended up being different than the original piece." And he was very dissatisfied. And I commended the young guy for not just believing me as an authority figure and believing this half-hearted demonstration. So it was kind of fun. And that relates to some of the demonstrations that Egyptology has come up with.
Yep.
We've all seen the shows on TV, the documentaries. They move a one-ton stone a few inches and say that's how 70-ton stones were moved.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's what they've come up with. Well, I can move a full-size car. I can pick a full-size car up over my head, and I could provide demonstration to justify that statement by picking up a Hot Wheels car.
Sure.
But my demonstration is flawed because of an issue of scale, just as my demonstration with the arrowhead was flawed because the results weren't the same as the original. So that's some of the shucking and jiving and the bait and switch that Egyptology does to try and demonstrate things that are literally impossible. So, again, Egyptology is in crisis right now, and as a stagnated mystery religion, if you will, and the future will not look kindly on Egyptology.
No, I think you're right. And I wanted to bring up something I thought was so interesting, which was the findings of the independent researcher and Hungarian surveyor István Soros, author of the book Pyramids on the Water.
Yes.
That's fascinating that locks were found between absolutely wild, between the Great Pyramid and the Nile. So what does that tell us?
Well, it tells us that the original builders were geniuses and that the original builders moved their heaviest objects, which are these big stones of the Great Pyramid, let's say, they moved those in the same manner that we move our heaviest objects in the 21st century. The system of choice that we use, the high technology we use, is water locks. They just expanded the Panama Canal with larger water locks. You know, they didn't use a magic wand or humming or worshiping crystals or anything like that, or dragging ships up a big ramp. They used water locks. So water locks are a efficient 21st century technology of choice that was used, we think, to build the Great Pyramid. And that book that you mentioned is really interesting.
Yes. And the Mason, it's just wild, because this provides so much backdrop and so much historical evidence, providing foundation to your findings, in my opinion, that it's hard for me to see how anyone can ignore this.
Well, they sure can.
Yeah.
They absolutely can. The Piltdown skull was discovered, and the experts, the anthropologists, said, oh, there it is. That's the missing link. It's right there. We can point to it. We can see it. It's the missing link. And it was acknowledged to be fact for about 40 years. And the reason why is because that's how long it took those anthropologists that wrote their doctoral thesis on the Piltdown skull. It took about 40 years for those guys to die off. The next generation of anthropologists said, oh yeah, the Piltdown skull, we can see the file marks on it, and it's fake. So the new generation of anthropologists, they knew it was fake, but neither generation of anthropologists changed their minds. So the best, I've heard it said that science advances funeral by funeral. So what we need is for these Egyptologists and other people to die off and let new people come to fore, if you will. And it's a struggle, and it's a battle, the revolution that we are in of ideas and concepts about ancient mankind's past.
So correct and so true. And you see, I see these locks going from the pyramids, and they make perfect sense. And you look at, for example, Dubai, where they're making these formations where there's extreme wealth because it's fun and it's easy, and it makes perfect sense. And it just kind of, they look so similar. Has there been, I kind of want to go more into Soros's, his history of that. Do you have any more information on that was not included?
About his book?
Yes. Yeah, about his findings and his book and the proof that there were.
Floating Stones, that book you're talking about?
That's the one, correct.
He had a lot of evidence. Certainly, I don't agree with everything that he says. He talked about a mechanical pump associated with the Sphinx. I don't particularly agree with that, which is mm-hmm. fine. Mm-hmm. We don't all have to agree with everything. But he did a brilliant job in terms of finding physical evidence, certainly for water on the Giza Plateau and surrounding areas. So, yeah, I would suggest people read that book and find out the same information that you're familiar with. So, how's that?
I think it's exactly right, because the demonstrations in the book are hard to beat. I mean, it's everything is laid out in such a very fit and easy, clean, accessible way that you're like, oh, that answers that question. Every time a question pops up, it's answered, in my opinion, quite quickly.
In his book.
Oh, no. Yeah, no. And also I wanted to get into the first three levels, and this is, sounds crazy, but I think that's all, this is all locks, and I don't want to give too much away about the book, but it makes sense. I'm from Costa Rica, and the Panama Canal isn't far from there. So maybe just because I've seen that in person and it seems so easy, it doesn't matter how much it weighs, you can move it. Can we go into that a little bit, just how this flotation system might work?
Well, certainly. The Great Pyramid, we think, was built level by level, including the casing stones that were on the outside. So when the Great Pyramid was assembled, the first stones, this is very abbreviated explanation, but the first stone set in place was the first level of casing stones. Those are the finely cut stones, and they're cemented together, bonded together, watertight, with a very strong bonding agent. So those stones make up a square wall, if you will, about 4.5 feet deep. The original builders filled that square wall with water, so you had a square pond on the Great Pyramid construction site. That's all you had. Well, they also built water locks from the catch basin in the Nile all the way up to the that pond, and those water locks could, if you will, communicate with the pond. There was a way to get from the water locks into the pond, you know, like a short canal or whatever, however you want to call it. Mm-hmm. So anyway, the next step of the construction was they brought the interior stones for the first level up the water locks effortlessly. You know, no strong back muscles were required. Those stones were on barges, so those interior stones for the first level went up the water locks. And they had a means, usually I think they used those floating barges, if you will, the sun barges, as a type of floating crane.
Mm-hmm.
They lifted the stone off of the barge and into the pond. So when that pond was filled up with stones that came up the water locks, the first level of the Great Pyramid was completed. Then they put on the second level of casing stones. So you had another wall on top of the first wall, if you will. And they added additional water into that enclosure, which filled the pond up to the second level, if you will, and also added water locks up the side of the Great Pyramid to connect to that pond. And then they lifted the moved stones from the catch basin in the Nile on barges all the way up the water locks, and then up the water lock on the incorporated into the casing stones. And then they filled in the second pond, if you will, with stones, interior stones, and the second level of the Great Pyramid was completed. And that process was systematic and efficient and fast. And that's how they assembled the Great Pyramid with ease, if you will.
Yeah, no broken backs. I like how you mentioned no broken backs, no crazy slave labor. And yeah, people were working, but these workers were most likely working. They were skilled sailors in a way. And I wanted to get into not so much the stone masonry, but also from your perspective and a lot of, I thought it was genius, all of the woodwork involved in the little the rafts and the ramps and the things in between the masonry, and how I think that's kind of where the magic happened.
True. Herodotus said that he was told by the priests that the Great Pyramid was built using short wooden planks, and the doors on water locks in the Panama Canal, in the Erie Canal in the United States, the waterlocked doors were made out of short wooden planks. Mm-hmm. So just as you're fascinated with that aspect of it, probably that became a myth that the priests who were tour guides were told, and it became that story about the short wooden planks. So yeah, it's, you know, a few barges that were reused, doors on pivots, that type of thing, stones that are cemented together, watertight, mm-hmm. and a supply of water, and they were able to build the Great Pyramid.
Yeah, I'm a fly fishing guide by trade, so, and a boatman at that. So we would row boats down a river. So I can imagine that the guys at the oars, or whoever was doing this, these tradesmen must have been at the top of their game, and definitely in a class of their own. And the construction just continues. It seems like, in my opinion, it just gets easier after the first three. I mean, after you get the base level done, the rest is, I don't want to describe it because it's so easy, but it just gets super simple at that point. And I wanted to ask you about your video series, just how cool that is. Where, let's get that out so listeners can find where to find your information. And then I wanted to ask you a bit about the construction again.
Well, the information about my books and documentaries and the video series that we're referring to are all located at our foundation's website at thepunk.org. And you can find out about the scholarship that we had. We also had a tour planned for Egypt, but that was canceled because of COVID. So we have to reschedule that. But you can see our itinerary and that type of thing. And, of course, links to my books and documentaries at thebump.org. But, the Great Pyramid, during construction, it would appear that the farther up you got, the faster it would go because the amount of material was less each level. So the first several levels would go fairly slowly in terms of raising vertically. But once you get up into the pyramid level by level, it would be, if you were watching the process, it would appear, oh, wow, they're going higher and higher, quicker and quicker. So, yeah, it's a fascinating explanation. And people, especially people like you that have actually read the books, often use the word compelling.
Yes.
So it's been an exciting experience writing these books, and I've certainly got a lot of blowback, but I've also got a lot of people that embrace the direction of research that we're following.
And I wanted to ask you about that blowback. However, in my opinion, using water locks and ponds and things to move these heavy payloads on barges is very consistent with the physical evidence. And I love how you just come back to that. The rationality is really just so obvious. And the misconceptions are just that. And I wanted to get into a little bit of the construction and really the biggest thing, which is the casing stones. And it keeps coming up because those casing stones being set in place, once you had that down, the rest of the plan, I want to just kind of get into how important the casing stones are to the overall construction.
Yes. They are. Oh, you're asking me?
Yeah,
they're,
yes.
For the construction. They're watertight, if you will, and help impound water for the process. And, you know, again, level by level, but they are more of a seal then they're not like a dam or anything like that. They are a seal. You know, the Great Pyramid wasn't built, and then these casing stones put on like a layer of plywood or anything, or roofing, if you will, but they're an integral part of the construction of the Great Pyramid. They're intertwined, if you will. The some of the interior stones are set on top of the back, if you will, of the casing stone. So it's all an integrated unit. It's not just like a dam, if you will. So, but the casing stones are very important. It's one aspect that indicates there's a profound link between water and the Great Pyramid.
Yes, and I like that you mentioned it's not just like a dam, because obviously the building was different and the hydrostatic pressure is different. And yeah. It's a solid structure that was used probably for, you know, I don't know. Is there any idea how long it was functional for?
I don't know that, but it wasn't built. And then they had a change of plans, like Egyptologists have just come up with that story. It was designed and built by geniuses, but how long it operated, I don't know. I think that it malfunctioned in the king's chamber and ultimately damaged the king's chamber and made the water pump inoperable, which I talk about in the book. So, but yeah, it is fascinating, unusual water pumping technology. We're trying to redevelop that. And not everyone would need a big pyramid in their backyard, but we would use polypropylene containers and PVC pipes and custom fabrication and that type of thing. That's why we have a facility. We're still looking to acquire a 3D printer if someone wants to donate that, or a plasma cutter, or even an air compressor to power the plasma cutter. You know, they need air compressor. So we have a facility that we're looking for both materials and tooling for our nonprofit. So I hope people go to our website, find out our goals, our activities, and that type of thing, and contact me through our website. But
You're right on. You're right on. And that's exactly correct. I think there's many ways to skin a cat, and the more people that are involved and get this message, the more evidence there is of other alternative history. And I wanted to get into the detractors, which you mentioned a bit of your theory of construction and how they've come at you and what kind of noticeable attempts they've made to sweep this under the rug.
The idea of the hydrostatic pressure is difficult for a lot of people to get their head around. They say, well, it's a dam that's 5 feet thick, or seven or so, that's over 400 feet tall. It can't work. That's what they say. But they use these very large stones, an extremely strong bonding agent that is stronger than the stone itself, and then they also intertwine all of these things. It's all an integral unit. So, but a lot of people, that's one thing they can't get their head around. They say that they just can't do it. But another thing that I have had difficulty with is people kind of just hear about this, and then they come up with their own preconceived notion through ignorance, and then they debunk the preconceived notion that they've come up with that has nothing to do with my research, then they think that it's invalid. So I have a lot of trouble with that, and then I have trouble with what I call non-book reading researchers. And I will be honest with you, you're the first host that I've had. I've done 150 radio interviews, and only about 10 of them have actually read my books. So a lot of people are critical of my research from a position of ignorance. I've had difficulty with that. A lot of lazy researchers out there, and that, you know, don't read a book. You know, that's the revolution we're in, is reading a book, not fighting in the streets. So
true.
That's a lot of the blowback I get. And also I get the blowback of, Egyptologists are experts, and let's find out what the experts say, and that's what's true. Well, settled science is settled science is one of the biggest inhibitors to the advancement of science. They used to, there's a meme on Facebook, they used to spray kids with DDT. You know, you had your child, and spray them with DDT. Well, the reason why they don't do that now is somebody questioned settled science. And they used to believe the bumps on people's heads had personality traits associated with them, and that was a very racist idea of phrenology. Well, they taught it in universities, but people have questioned settled science, and that isn't accepted anymore. So there's a lot of lazy people that say, oh, you're going against Egyptologists? Well, if you could get an Egyptologist to agree with you, then I would agree with you. So,
yeah.
And then, of course, the other explanation that's popular in modern times is the idea that the Great Pyramid was symbolic or points to something or whatever. So people would rather be into those correlations than figure out the whole aspect of my research. And people now, believe it or not, are not as technical as they think they are. They think they can install an app on their phone and there are some technological geniuses, but most people I know have difficulty opening the hood of their car or identifying the components in there. So this research is very technical, if you will, you know, as complicated to explain as a V8 engine, but that complexity doesn't detract from its validity. So, but then there's people like you that actually read the books, and wow, that's interesting and compelling. And people that are work in shipyards or work on the railroad or car mechanics, people that actually do stuff, or people that have seen the Panama Canal say, wow, this is interesting. And so that's the two types of people I encounter, the blowback type of people and, you know, the people that actually conduct their own research.
Yeah, and, you know, it's not that it's that. To me, it's a no-brainer, but I only say that because we're talking about 70-ton stones, 20 stories high, and, you know, each successive construction phase is very well explained. And for people that like the way, like you said, systematically, the way things work, this is it, in my opinion. It is basically it. And I don't think... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
You're very kind to say that. I get a lot of blowback. I get people say, well, what's simpler, a series of water locks they had to make or a ramp? And I would say, well, a ramp, I guess, is simpler. Well, if you go with Occam's razor, then that means the simplest idea is right, and we don't need the water locks. So they're done. They're done with the research. But in the 1830s, people said, well, we know about ramps and we know about water locks. What are we going to do? And then they ended up building the Erie Canal, mm-hmm. which was the most expensive public works project in the New World. So why didn't they just use a ramp? They should have used Occam's razor. Well, you know, you get what I'm trying to get at?
Oh, yes. And I think
sometimes.
Yeah, I think there was no massive. I mean, that massive ramp, those same people that believe in the massive ramp believe that it was most wretched slave labor, where I guarantee you there weren't bathroom breaks, and this muddy ramp was nothing more than human stained, horrible, I mean, just a procession of death. That seems unlikely compared to these other very obvious, in my opinion, it's really structural and engineering based perspectives.
I appreciate that. Yeah. The Great Pyramid is an engineering project, and you can certainly look at it in that regard. You don't have to even know what language they spoke or what gods they worshipped. And it is a kind of a purifying way to look at the Great Pyramid, to study how it was built, because you can peel off all those layers, you know, all the cultural layers, even when it was built or who built it. You can just look at it in a technical aspect, you can get rid of a lot of those misconceptions that cocoon the Great Pyramid, because it's been researched with a lot of poor research techniques. So the Orion correlation theory, it doesn't even consider how the Great Pyramid was built. So, you know, that's, I think, a flaw. You know, they understand all these esoteric correlations, but how were stones moved from one place to another? Mm-hmm. They can't even address it.
Correct.
So it's interesting. Yeah, so it is. It's an engineering marvel, you know, just like the Notre Dame. It's an engineering marvel. Doesn't matter what it says in the Bible if you want to know how it was built, you know.
That's
doesn't
correct.
Doesn't matter what language they spoke, you know, the people that built it. So if you want to know how it was built. So it's a way to get loose from all of these preconceived notions. You know, people say, oh, well, how it was built, well, this pointed to such and such a star. Well, yeah, you don't even have to consider that. Just, you know, how it was built. And it's a good place to start to understand that structure. You know, if you read books about skyscrapers, they tell you how it was built and what they use them for. I read a book about aircraft carriers. It was about how it was built, what they're used for. So that's kind of where I'm at on a technical level.
It's great.
Instead of made up correlations or a tomb notion.
Yes. And there's, for those that want secrets and mystery, there's so many secrets and mystery in the book. You got to buy it. It goes into how the capstone was placed. And just imagine how this must look to somebody going down the Nile, you know, going by seeing this built or seeing it completed. And it was declared, I have to read this because it's so neat. It was declared by Herod, I'm sure I'm going to murder this word, Herodotus, the priests, and he recorded that the Great Pyramid was built level by level from the bottom up, but was most assuredly finished from the top down. And that just kind of jives, in my opinion, with everything that the book goes into.
Oh, wow. This is a pleasant surprise to have such a proponent as a host, and, you know, that made my day, and it is, you are a researcher, and I consider you reading my book to be peer-reviewed.
Oh, thank you so much. And in conclusion, sir, I just, you know, it's just the most obvious choice. Where can our listeners, what's the easiest place for them to get to this truth and get to questioning and get some of the answers behind this brilliant project? We've mentioned the website. Where can they buy the books? Is it also available at that same website?
Yeah, the links are available at that same website. They're sold through Amazon, of course. The books are available in softcover or Kindle ebook format. And my two documentaries that complement the two books are also available on DVD. And there, you can get those on Amazon.com. So I just ask people to be like you and consider the evidence and conduct research and find out what it's all about before you pass judgment. And it is, you know, it is a very viable alternative for an explanation of this ancient structure made by geniuses that were our ancestors. And the idea of water pump, I think, is the hugest and biggest return on investment for any purpose suggested for the Great Pyramid. So again, visit us at thepump.org. You can contact me through email from that website. And if you have questions or want to know about our activities or want to become involved, you know, instead of just writing LOL on Facebook or watching sports or whatever, or just taking up air, get involved in a project, not necessarily mine, but do something, you know. People watch all these movies about superheroes. Be a superhero. You know, if your neighbor is older, go help them by mowing their lawn. You know, that would make you a superhero.
Yep.
Paint your neighbor's fence, or go get involved in a civic organization, or get involved with our organization. Find out what we're about. Pray for us. We accept prayer. And spread the word, like mention us on Facebook or social media. Visit our YouTube channel and, you know, like a video or anything. So there's a lot people can do to become involved or to find out what this is all about. And the best place to start is at thepump.org.
So neat. And for those experienced and technically oriented people, The Lost Technologies of the Great Pyramid is a great place to start. There's a second book as well, and definitely get that too, that goes into the Prosperity Pyramid. And I can't thank you enough for your time. I know it's very valuable, Mr. Stephen Myers, and I hope to have you again, hopefully in the future, and I hope you have a great day. Thank you, sir.
Oh, thank you. I hope to be on again, and I really enjoyed our conversation.
Thanks so much. Thanks for bringing a little truth into a very muddled arena. And until next time, sir, all the best, and keep your eyes to the skies.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Stephen Myers. I am going to post links to everything. Everything about this truth, everything about this amazing, in my opinion, discovery about the pyramids that, like many things historically, whenever you have lost technologies, they are just kind of swept under the rug. It's a lot easier to not endure or look at a situation, and it's a sad thing, but we have to be agents of debonding. In other words, these lesser known technologies, we need to bring them out to the public knowledge. And it's been long enough that science has demonstrated how they can sweep these things under the rug by not looking at them. Let's just take a look at them. Nothing wrong with taking a look at them and checking them out for their merit, because if we had to build a massive pyramid in the desert, I'm just talking about where I'm at here in Las Vegas, I'll tell you what, I think I know who I would hire to build it, and it wouldn't be the guy with the blood-stained, feces-stained mud ramp full of slaves pulling rocks up to a forsaken death for all eternity. Who knows how long that construction project would take? Or would it be this clean, mean machine, which just brought rocks up like it was nobody's business, with these sweet dudes on the oars, on these cool little, you need to see these little, they look like dories, but these little barges going up these channels. Definitely check it out. By Lost Technologies of the Great Pyramid by Stephen Myers. Until next time, keep your eyes to the skies, feet on the ground, but don't forget to take a look around.
Blast off in my time machine. Third eye feeling like a Nevisine. Blast off, blast off, blast off, blast off. Come blast off in my time machine. Third eye feeling like a Nevisine. Blast off, blast off, blast off.